Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway and I'm reading my way through the 1977 first edition Advanced Dungeons & Dragons Monster Manual. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find therein, about their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games. Not just games of AD&D, but any games. Today, we're continuing our push through the R section of the Monster Manual, and indeed, we're going to complete it with the Rock, the Roper, the Rot Grub, and the Rust Monster. But before we do that, it's time to thank a new Patreon supporter. This is someone who's gone to patreon.com/monsterman and pledged as little as $1 a month to help support the show. And if, like today's patron, you pledge at the $2 level or higher, you'll also get access to my new podcast, Patron Deities, in which I do for the Deities and Demigods supplement what I'm doing for the Monster Manual, and use it as a springboard to talk about world mythology and how to use religion and mythology in your games. So thank you very much, David, for supporting Monster Man on Patreon. Also, I've got some listener mail to read. Now, this is a message that I did get just before I did the episode 50 listener mailbag special, but I missed the notification of a comment on Libsyn, so that was my bad. This message comes to us from listener Richard Scott. Now, Richard is the man behind Otherworld Miniatures, supporters of the Monster Man contest, and generous donors of prizes to our finalists. So thank you, Richard. Richard writes, "What is next after the Monster Manual is all done? Personally, I'm hoping that you'll say Fiend Folio. I'm a big fan of that book, but I know it's one of those love-it-hate-it AD&D books, with apparently most of the hate coming from the US side of the pond. I know it has a certain UK flavor to it, with a lot of quirky, even weird beasties, but I guess that's why I love it, along with the superb interior art, most notably by Russ Nicholson. Anyway, I think you're in the perfect place to do it justice, as a Yank among Brits, and particularly living in Cambridge, where the TSR UK creative juices flowed so productively in the early 80s. And it's from Richard and Harry Scott. Harry, also a listener, and another entrant in the Monster Man contest, creator of the ferocious were-tiger shark. So, thanks for listening, Richard and Harry. Yeah, Fiend Folio is what we're going to do next. Actually, after the end of this, I'm going to call it season, we're going to take a short break. That doesn't mean there will be no more new episodes, but it does mean that I'll be doing kind of one-off or two-off episodes on particular topics, you know, monsters from different, you know, books or articles, but ones that I couldn't get a whole season out of. Just, you know, so I'm going to do a bunch of little kind of one-shots. And then, after, you know, maybe 3 or 4 weeks of those, I'm going to start season two, and then we're going to do Fiend Folio. I agree that the Fiend Folio had kind of a mixed reception, and there was certainly some criticism of it from the US end, especially when it came out. I think that a lot of American gamers were looking for a more traditional fantasy atmosphere, and that maybe the Fiend Folio didn't satisfy that. I think it's undergone something of a critical reevaluation since then, is more appreciated than it was. But I think also, and I'm going to talk about this in the first episode of the Fiend Folio season, I think it suffers from the difficult second album problem. And in particular, it kind of messes with the balance of types of monster in a way that was unavoidable. I have some theories about this, but I'll talk about them when I get to them. And yeah, it's always excited me that the TSR UK was right here in Cambridge. I think some of the people were associated with, in fact, the department that I was in, the archaeology department. So, kind of cool. But yeah, anyway, thank you so much for writing in, and thanks for your continuing support of the show. All right, let's get cracking. First up, we got the Rock. The Rock is a creature from Persian and Arabian folklore. You get them all around sort of the Indian Ocean area. They also turn up in Ethiopia, and a lot of people argue that they live in Madagascar. I think Marco Polo says they're from Madagascar. I could be wrong about that. Yeah, and they're basically giant eagles. The specific thing that they're known for is carrying away elephants, like an eagle might carry away a lamb, which is a wonderful way of suggesting the size of these creatures. They're as much bigger than an eagle as an elephant is bigger than a lamb. I guess that the times that they would come up in your AD&D game or in your fantasy role-playing game are mainly twofold. First off, you've got the, like, let's get into the rock's nest, right? So the king's prize elephant or, the miller's kid or whatever has been captured by the rock, has been taken away to the nest, and we know that it takes things to its nest to devour them later, or maybe to feed them to its babies. And so you would have to go up there and get into the nest and get out the valuable thing. And while you're up there, as the Monster Manual mentions, the nest is littered with treasure, because the rock doesn't eat all these swords plus one and bracers of defense and staffs of command fish. It just eats up the good bits and leaves this inedible junk lying around. So the rock's nest could almost be like a little bit of a dungeon, particularly if you said that the rock was nesting in some kind of ruined structure, which it might. The other is, remember how I'm always saying that you don't want to give too many flying mounts to your party lest they turn into some kind of fighter squadron of Pegasus Knights? But what if you did? If you're gonna go Pegasus Squadron, then this seems like an ideal opportunity to have a big mid-air fight against a rock. After the rock, we have the Roper. Oh, one last thing about the rock. Ibn Battuta, who actually has a lot of good D&D-able material in amongst the sort of general travelogue nature of his book. Ibn Battuta mentions, I mean, come to that, you should read all the Arabic travel writers, right? I mean, Ibn Fahlan's got some good stuff in there too. There's a lot of them. It's a whole genre in medieval Arabic literature. Anyway, Ibn Battuta says that sailors sometimes think they see a mountain hovering over the ocean, but it's actually a rock, which is kind of a neat image, although a mountain hovering in the ocean is also fun. Anyway, after the rock, we've got the Roper. Now, this is like the fourth monster we've had so far that is a monster that appears to be a normal feature of a dungeon or cavern and then, you know, nabs people when they come past, right? The architectural ambush predator. I guess the Roper is sort of like a conical being that looks a bit like a stalagmite. It sort of looks like the creature from It Conquered the World, only with tentacles instead of claws. And the idea is you think it's just a regular stalagmite, and then you get close to it or take cover behind it, and then it lashes out and wraps you with its tendrils, or ropes as they are known, drags you in and eats you up. This is fine. It is the fourth monster with this gimmick that we've had so far, right? The Lurker above, the Mimic, the Piercer, and now the Roper. And I know that we're going to get at least one more. We're going to get the thing that looks like floors. Is that the Trapper? But basically, the Lurker below. It's not a bad gimmick. I do wonder if we need five of them, but I guess they all fulfill different niches within the ecology. Again, I reiterate always to be careful about using these because they can produce this particular let's tap every square with a 10-foot pole playstyle, which I personally don't want to encourage. A lot of what people think should and shouldn't be included in D&D games is very much the product of their personal circumstances, and that's definitely the case for me. I tend to play on weeknights, so one of the things that I like to discourage in my D&D games is what, for want of a better word, I will call rigmarole. That is to say, stuff that takes a long time. Now, this is a shame because rigmarole can, in fact, be a useful tension-building tool. I just, you know, when your game session is 3 hours long, you just don't have time for it. But everybody's game is different, and there certainly is a value in that sense of paranoia and unease. The problem is, it's hard to switch off. You know, once you've established that there are mimics and lurkers above and so on, once you've established that there are mimics and lurkers above and so on everywhere, that kind of becomes what your game is about in a way that I think could ultimately be harmful. But again, there's certainly a place for it. Next, we have the Rot Grub. Now, the Rot Grub is in danger of being a gotcha monster. You put your hand somewhere you shouldn't, it gets infested with rot grubs, and D3 turns later, you're dead. You have to know that you can kill them by applying fire to the wound, or having someone cast a cure disease spell on you. There are quite a lot of things that can be solved by casting a cure disease spell on someone that do not fall within what I would understand to be the definition of a disease. I assume that this is actually covered in the wording of the spell. I don't know. Anyhow, rock grubs are okay, I suppose. They're a little bit of a landmine. They're kind of like ear seekers. I wasn't too keen on those either, but I will say that they have a very nice illustration. I'm particularly fond of this mustachioed male fighter who looks like he just stepped out of the Bayeux Tapestry. The way in which adventurers are portrayed in this book as this sort of mashup of medieval and ancient stuff, you know, you can tell that there's a military history buff drawing these, and that's I quite like that. It makes me happy. It's really interesting how different they look from the much more explicitly fantastic characters seen in later editions of D&D, particularly like 3rd. You know, 3rd really introduced that dungeon punk aesthetic, and then later editions have maybe drifted back a little more toward something more grounded in history, but not wholly. One thing they have done is introduce more different kinds of history, which I think is really interesting and desirable, but that's another story. Anyway, it's a fun illustration. I don't think it's a monster that I would be likely to use, again, without kind of signposting it, but that's just because of the way that I think about what makes for an entertaining threat. Finally, we got the Rust Monster. Old Rusty. I do like Rust Monsters. I like the fact that they are disproportionately feared by player characters. So the Rust Monster basically looks like a giant flea with a propeller for a tail. It is another one of the Chinasaur monsters. That is to say that it's based on a set of cheap plastic prehistoric animal toys, the same that inspired the Bullet and the Owlbear and possibly the Umber Hulk. The one time I used Rust Monsters in the campaign that I finished up last year, one of my players emitted what I can only describe as a high-pitched squeak when he realized what the creatures I was describing were, and backpedaled furiously. I think there's something about the prospect of losing your stuff that makes characters very, that makes players very unhappy. And I think that's true even in early editions of Dungeons & Dragons. You can see that in today's version of the game, players might be very unhappy about the idea of losing their armor because they know that that could really happen. Whereas, typically, they probably don't expect to die, right? They can get cure wounds on them, they can get revivify, but there's no cure wounds for your rusted armor, is there? Well, I mean, just mending would probably fix it. But also, I think, even in early versions of the game where character death was relatively likely and things were meant to be easy come, easy go, I think players just really object to the idea of losing their stuff. You can die, but you're gonna take the Black Razor with you when you do. Now, I think the Rust Monsters are great. I love, in particular, the fact that they are this disproportionately feared threat. I like that they give, under the right circumstances, monks, rangers, druids, etc., a chance to shine. I like the idea that, you know, even the most noble paladin has cudgel in his pack just in case he ever runs into any Rust Monsters, or, you know, a sling with some stone bullets. They can be one of those things where it's like, oh, fighters to the rear, spellcasters will take care of this, which can take some of the fun out of it, but still I think they're pretty great. And the illustration is a fantastic one. They've been redesigned a few times slightly to make them look a little more quote-unquote realistic, but ultimately staying pretty close to the original. So Rust Monsters are a genuine classic. And that is it for the R section. Join me next time as I talk about the Shugans on Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
Do you have a favorite monster? Do you have something you'd like me to talk about? Find me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or send me an email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. If you want to support the podcast, you can do so at patreon.com/monsterman, where you'll find lots of extra bonus content and my brand new show, Patron Deities, in which I explore the deities and demigods Advanced Dungeons & Dragons book. Check it out. Thanks for listening.